Wow, that's new.
Why did it say that? Could you hear that? Or it said
that? That's never happened before.
Never. Well, Zoom is always new things.
Adding new new features, huh?
Well, we're trying to be the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, even though Zoom is taking over our feed. This is the Rhetorician Files, episode 10 with Dave Payne. We're back. 10 episodes. Hi, Dan. It's pretty good. We're trying to decide whether the right side of Dave's face there has become ghostly or supernatural in some way with the light.
I guess we're just at a later hour where the sun's moving in the sky or something.
Maybe. That most people, I'm sure, aren't even watching this or listening to it, so they don't know what we're talking about, but he's a little ghostly on the right. But it's fine. I think it's actually what it's always been. We're just, because of Elizabeth's keen eye, we're now paying attention to it.
There you go.
So this is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, once again, talking to comedians about politics, converting the right, and gleaning information and perspectives from rhetoricians, which is what this is. So this week, we've been talking about story the last couple of weeks, and this week we're moving into, again, a more topical area. It's one of those kind of sexy phrases that gets thrown out a lot in the media right now, and everybody's worried about it. It's the big lie. We're going to talk about the big lie today, which is in itself, like, I mean, it's selling itself, right? It's become a thing because it's got a nice title.
I think so. Right. And I think there's, you know, there's kind of a collaboration involved in sort of endorsing how big the lie is. So how big is it? Who's lying to whom? And
yeah, it's crazy.
How things I've been thinking about lately.
Yeah. It splinters very quickly. You get a nice little panorama of kaleidoscope of lying and deception in this issue. And of course, like right now, the big lie applies to Trump and the GOP's ongoing desire to say that the election was rigged. And you sent me a set of statistics this morning that it's worked. The fact that they just say this over and over again, that it was somehow a faked election, has got like 60% of Republicans or something?
66, although I've heard it higher. That seems to be the lowest I've heard so far, because last week I heard somebody report 70, and then I think right after the election, it was something like 73% or something. So we maybe fewer than ever before, but it depends on the polls. But now the stuff that we've looked at, didn't the phrase the big lie itself come from Hitler, right?
It's Goebbels, right?
Well, what I'm looking at is saying that he never said that, but that the phrase is actually in Mein Kampf. But as an opening salvo, right, this is the OSS. The OSS is the precursor of the CIA and the Internet, you know, Bureau of Research, right? Anyway, this is how they profiled Hitler. His primary rules were never allow the public to cool off, never admit a fault or wrong, never concede that there may be some good in your enemy, never leave room for alternatives, never accept blame, concentrate on one enemy at a time and blame him for everything that goes wrong. People will believe a big lie sooner than a little one, and if you repeat it frequently enough, people will sooner or later believe it.
So that's right from Mein Kampf, or is that the profile?
Well, the big lie portion is from Mein Kampf, where he talked about the phrase big lie occurs, and the rationale being everybody tells little lies, but they don't see themselves as capable of telling the big lie. So that's where the big lie is more convincing than the little lie comes from. And apparently Goebbels never says that directly. So,
okay.
At least that's what the latest thing I read said, but anyway.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, Hitler was not very original. Like, he borrowed almost everything that he ever said. So he probably borrowed it from somewhere else.
Could be.
If anybody's tracked that down.
I think there is a thing that Goebbels repeated that later at some point. But anyway.
Well, that sounds like.
But the point being, at least at that time, is that neither he nor Hitler would ever admit that they were lying.
Right.
That never happened. when they used the big lie, they were actually accusing Jews or other people of doing the lying rather than saying that this is a strategy. So it's really our former CIA saying this about Hitler in that phrase that I quoted.
And you heard this, I mean, very recently, Trump literally reversed it and said that the big lie is people lying that the election wasn't rigged.
Right.
That this will go down in history as the biggest lie.
There you go. That's the other strategy, right?
So I think one of the things this points up about rhetoric that people don't really get, there's a lot of foundational theory issues here about the problems that language has in holding on to truth anyway. And then there's manufactured strategy about truth. And that's what this is. And what people don't really realize, I think in a lot of ways about rhetoric, is how much of our stuff is manufactured. It's a choice. And then they run that strategy in a lot of different tactics. And so when people run into that, they want to discredit all public discourse or all language or all, you know, leaders and officials because they're now manufacturing truth in some way. And it's a clumsy way of looking at it, I think, in the broad sense. But in the small sense, the mid-sized sense of strategy, people are, they're going nuts right now because they're seeing it done in front of their face so blatantly by Trump and the right.
It is the hugeness, right? And maybe the unflinchingness of it, right? And the attempt to make it, enduring, I think. I mean, there's kind of the momentary lies, Ted Cruz saying, well, I really was only going to Cancun to make sure my kids were safe. I wasn't really going to vacation or enjoy myself for 4 or 5 days. These little lies work. Okay, those have no preservative value, but because even Hitler and friends recognize that sooner or later the lie comes up against truth. And I think maybe that testifies in many ways to what we have observed before in our conversations, that people not taking information outside of their own particular bubble. The other part of those statistics was how, and I guess this isn't surprising at all and somewhat circular, but how much the belief in the big lie correlates with your news source. For those who only believe Fox News and other alternative news sources, the percentage of those believing in the big lie is huge, right? So the big lie swearers to are the people who believe the big lie, I guess is the, in short, tend to be folks who do not take in information except from the kind of the bubble, right?
Right. So if we look at some of the anchors of truth, like the things that help people establish truth, one of them has to be that you get a wide array of information, right?
Sure.
So if you go down just one information avenue, no matter what it is, you're not really going to consider the alternatives very often.
Right, and I think that also, as we maybe observed about some people think they're taking in a number of sources, but it's really all the same source repeating itself through different mouths, right?
Right.
So. Well, we think we're making choices when we choose between 18 different brands, but that prevents us from choosing not to use that product at all in some ways.
Yeah, and one of the things I point out to people is that the right, organizes its communication through an infrastructure going all the way from think tanks down to media and into politicians' mouths. And so it is the same information over and over again. The script is the same. No matter who's saying it, the lie is the same,
And well, and I think that's part of the big lie technology is how can you echo it? I think that is also part of the propaganda bots on Facebook make this appear that it's coming from a number of sources and therefore collaborated. So I think simulating consensus has got simulating a new technology.
Truth. Yeah, that whole simulation of truth. Like right. They use all the truth anchors, all the truth mechanisms to make it seem true.
And if you just follow those around, you think you've done your due diligence, and but instead you've been trapped in a set of false discriminations, right? So you think you've done the intellectual work of checking something, when indeed you've just been sort of duped into a set of false choices, right?
So. Yeah, I used to explain it in the food world that a lot of people tried to lose weight from consumption, the consumption food machine, you know, which grabs everybody. And the way they did that was by moving over into diet products. So, you know, diet Pepsis versus Pepsis, and then, but it's the same world. They're owned by the same people. I'm like, you have not yet escaped the food rhetoric world. You're still in the same world. They're still got you. Like, it's not until you go out over into like completely healthy foods, or you're buying from local farmers only and making that kind of food, that you get outside the consumption system. And this is the same way with the big lie. Once a, you know, whatever the machinery is or the institution is, has adopted that rhetoric, like they, this week with Liz Cheney, they had to get rid of her because she was a high profile person within that rhetoric universe who would not use that rhetoric.
Right. She didn't get ousted because she didn't believe the big lie. She got ousted because she wouldn't keep her mouth shut about that fact. Right. She wouldn't participate in the deception. That because it seemed to then emerge as a matter of policy. Both McCarthy and Mitch McConnell had gone on public saying, yeah, Trump, you know, this isn't true. But then they decided that was going to be politically unpopular and just started, you know, keeping their mouth shut about that. And then I think it just emerged as sort of our party stance on this is we're not going to talk about this because we don't want to disabuse those supporters who believe this, right? And that's where that was the infidelity that she committed. So yeah, it wasn't believing the truth, but speaking it, I guess.
Speaking the truth. So when you look at the history of this, okay, so let's see if we can get some context for this. Like, I keep looking at it, like we went back to the Nazis to start because clearly Hitler grabbed onto these techniques and just ramped them up like a good psychotic would, with absolutely no shame or conscience about it whatsoever. And that's never really taken root other than, I guess, here with McCarthyism. Like, is that the only thing historically where people use those same techniques to go after a subset of evil conspirators?
Well, I suppose the Inquisition. I guess there's probably cases that one could qualify, but I think, you know, we talked about modern propaganda, and I think the complicity of media in this is a significant factor. So.
You mean the conscious complicity or the unconscious complicity of just...
Well, just the enabling technology of it, the participation of the masses rather than, you know, the feedback loop is what sometimes is referred to as the echo chamber, I guess, right? I think accelerates the widespread nature of it and... so that you could simulate the truth as a consensual reality more readily. You then start providing evidence of that, right? It's like, it's a strange, maybe abstract analogy, but it always upsets me a bit when journalists start interviewing journalists because the journalist is the expert,
right?
That's to me a sure sign of the echo chamber, right? The journalist is not supposed to be giving testimony because basically their specialty is supposed to be reporting the other sources. So at any rate, that seems to me to be an indication that when we recycle these things over and over and over again through the media and media institutions, then we are at a different kind of simulation.
Yeah, and I started to look at this week. There's so many, again, it touches into so many different areas. But this idea that if you look at the body of rhetoric and even political rhetoric, and this has become a little cancer area, the lying, you know, no matter the scope, whether it's the big lie or the small lie, any type of lie that's accepted in public discourse versus mistakes. Like right now they're doing this to Biden. They're still fact checking Biden because they had to do that with Trump. So now I guess they're trying to be balanced and doing it with Biden. Like Biden may make mistakes. He may make exaggerations. He plucks pieces of information that are helpful to him, but that's traditional politics. That's not big lie politics.
It's not big lie.
You know?
Right. And you were talking a minute ago, it occurred to me that an example of sort of going into these little tide pools is whataboutism, that you seem to be participating in an intellectual exercise of nullifying this bias with this bias, and thinking, well, because of this or on the other hand, this, and that intellectual exercise makes you think you've sorted this out in an objective way, when indeed you've bought a set of premises and characterizations that, you know, really just sort of negate the possibility of coming to the truth. So I think in one of your podcasts the other day, you were discussing something with a young woman who was, well, okay, did Trump incite a riot? Well, what about Maxine Waters over here?
Yeah.
And once again, having sort of compared the two cases and their ambiguities, discovered that if he isn't guilty, then she, you know, if he's guilty, then she is. None of that matters, right? You have to start from the premise that there's nothing that Maxine Waters can do that makes this okay, right?
Right.
Instead of kind of getting into the legal subdivision of what is incitement or what isn't incitement, completely without context of, right, the political issues that one person is addressing versus the other person is addressing. So, but once again, having gone through that exercise, one thinks they've done a rational, logical process of being objective, when all you've done is pursue your bias.
Yeah, right? And I'm seeing this a lot. I'm seeing people, it's like watching people try to work heavy machinery, like caterpillar level heavy machinery without any training. And when they go into logic, I keep running into people now that are literally, their compass is broken. So they're using a lot of the standard language of, in fact, this week, some guy that believes the big lie is a friend of mine, completely into it about the vaccine. He's never going to get vaxxed, all that kind of stuff. But he also quoted Noam Chomsky to me. And I'm you have messed your compass. It's the right compass of finding, you know, cabals and you know, governmental strategies that we don't get to hear and all this stuff. But your compass is broken. Like it's pointing north and south at the same time. Like, how can you look at Noam Chomsky's deconstruction of like Israel and what Israel's done for the last 30, 40 years and compare that with, oh yeah, well, we're also lying about, you know, the election, like Biden's lying about the election. I'm like, your compass is broken. How did that happen? How did you get that de-simulated or over-simulated?
Well, so, I mean, I think where you were headed a minute ago, the big lie is itself kind of a covering, a wall that one runs up against. And if we start to break it down, there's the big myth that is a bunch of people believe in stuff. There's the big troll, which is a lot of people are willing to say this because they know it will agitate the other side. And then a lot of people are, you know, then there's the big scam, which is they know it's wrong, but they are willing to perpetuate it, right? And so lie is itself not a simplicity. There's layers. So some people are willing to believe anything. Some people are willing to say anything. And some people are willing to lie about anything to get elected, right? So I think you got the morphology here.
Yeah. That's why I said, like, when you go in and start breaking this apart, and this is my bigger issue about logos in general. And in my book, I start with the Logos Coliseum, and just to show people how broken it is, it's like berserker logic in there now. So right. Now, like where before you might walk in there and you may be somewhat aware of how to do logic and rationality and argument and those kind of things and the structures that make those doable, because they're not natural in any way. to actually slow step your way through thinking processes, constantly looking for mistakes, constantly taking in new sources. That's an unnatural cognitive act, I think, for most people. And what's happened in that Colosseum is you've had all these berserkers just run in, and they're doing, you know, they're fighting with the same weapons, but in different ways. And now people can't tell the difference. So I'm seeing all this berserker logic that people have just, you know, absorbed, and you can feel it in them. And so when you start logic like that, like you get things like big lies become possible in a lot in an anti-logic environment or a skewed logic environment.
Well, in this, you know, part of what is troubling me, at least that I think is related to what you're saying, is I think the media, the liberal media, if one can even buy into that phrase, such as it is, which for some people is all of it, but you know. The properly liberal, liberally biased or slanted media, the Democrats have an investment in the size of the lie. In other words, I think the bigness of it becomes, this is a real problem of concern. So you start kind of parsing this out. If you take that statistic and just for the moment sort of buy into these polls a little bit, that 66% of Republicans believe that the election was stolen. Well, only 29% of the public identifies as Republican. So who are we talking about? And what seems to be a longstanding factor in you know, we observe well during the Obama years, but even before, is that there's about 21 to 25% of the public who will believe almost anything, right?
Right.
And always did. So what's different here isn't that there's this group of people who will believe something that preposterous. It is a way in which they've been voiced, I think, in the conversation that may be different. So if you look at the, you know, what 66% of the 29% of Republican, and even if we expand that, so this particular poll, somehow those Republicans who believe, people who voted Republican who believe that Trump, or that the election was stolen, 38%, something like that, are wholly believe the big lie, but only 28% sort of kind of believe it, right? And so you get to 66%. So at any rate, once again, once you start parsing, who are we talking about that actually believes this? And then what are the rest of you doing, right? If 66% of the Republican voters are willing to say they kind of, yeah, they're so sure of it, or they kind of are leaning in that direction, then that means a whole bunch of other people know better. And that's only a subset of something like 44% of the population anyway.
But they're going along with it the same. It feels like, and again, it's all this.
It's their scam, yeah.
It's just analogy, you know, thinking in some ways that there's, I was watching, I watched a segment of a Goebbels speech, and he was doing the Hitler. He talked just like Hitler, right? They had a style that they all did, the, you know, flailing around and big emotion. And they interviewed somebody who was actually at a really old German woman who was at that talk. And she's like, yeah, you know, like maybe a third of the people in there were into it. But then my girlfriend elbowed me and was like, clap, because the guys next to us are like really hardcore and they thought they're gonna get their ass kicked. So, you know, all those sort of social forces, the lie itself is one thing, you know, the cognitive location, the cognitive territory that the lie gets. And that's kind of what you're talking about, right? Is it really in there? Is it partially in there? Is it just, they're going along with it as a scam? So there's the cognitive stuff, but then there's also the social aspect to this. And I see this a lot too with, I've had a friend once who was very adamant about Hillary selling children. This was before the whole Pizzagate thing, like something that she had done as a lawyer, that she had sold out children or something. And she got very mad about it. And I watched people around her, like just freeze, like nobody wanted to touch this bomb. Right, and so the sociality of that original belief is a real thing too. So when you start to look at The Big Lie, I can start to see why it has such political value, because it has those ramifications around it, those echoes going around it, those ripples that.
Right. And the other component that you've identified is you don't have to get even 50% belief in order for it to perpetuate. So maybe an amendment to the formulation about the big lie is that if you're lying about stuff big enough that you really can't be argued with, or crazy enough it can't be argued with, right? Where do you start the argument? No, Joe Biden does not consume the faces of babies on a daily basis in the White House. You're beyond discourse somehow, I guess, right? And so I think there is power in that kind of crazy behavior.
Well, that's part of it too. When I look at, so let's put big lie over here, right? We got the whole big lie world. Is there big truth? Like, is that what academics is sold? Like logic and training and rhetoric? Are we selling big truth to counter this? And what does that look like? To me, like the big lie is just berserker logic. Whereas big truth, even mid truth, would be like, how could anybody believe that when you look over here? But they have better story, they have better villains, they have crazy scenarios. And so everybody keeps getting pulled in, I think, by story and by the emotion of it, social aspects of it versus the cognitive aspects. And big truth just seems to want to sit in cognition, and it doesn't answer these other things.
Right. Well, I think, if you turn and there's danger in doing that. If you turn toward asking about the academic game, epistemics, whatever, it's all coded into methodology. That's why it seems like cognition rather than mythology. So
No, you can't destroy the entire architecture for people of cognition with calling it mythology, which of course it is, but
but I'm saying a lot of things get smuggled in as methodology, which are really not, but to certify truth with methodology is kind of the scientific compact here, or mythology.
It's one of those things, like, here's a dry process that anybody can follow and reach truth.
Well, I mean, just at the most simple level, science can change its mind every week, but certify the truth of itself at every turn, right? And we regard it as truth telling, even though it's constantly under revision. How do you pull that off? And I think that particular weakness there, especially when science leaves pure science and goes into social sciences and other domains where perhaps it is not best suited to trying to describe, people's moral judgments, et cetera. That's why that slippage creates, I think, it runs up against and has never eclipsed these other forms of truth, right? Drawn from religious mythology.
Right. Well, and I mean, let's just lay it out there. Religion is the original big lie.
Well, I guess all of these things could be said of.
There's 4,000 religions on the planet. Certainly some of them are just making up fiction, right? They can't all be true. So, I mean, we accept big lies as human beings. It's not abnormal for us at all. When you look at something like big truth, like science wants to avoid it wants the sacrosanct space where it can't be questioned. That's why I always went for rhetoric. Like, to me, rhetoric is big truth because it's constantly giving you techniques for looking at the other areas that claim to be true. So it's the deconstructor behind
truth. Also a method, right?
Sure. But it's the closest we've got that at least you don't have a single method in rhetoric. You move across methods for whatever has the best explanation. So you stay aware that this is a construction, Big truth, but big truth ends up hobbling itself as opposed to going after big lie, it seems like. Like, right. We're so good at questioning our own truth building.
Well, sure. And I, that scientific characterization is an idealism, that from the times of Plato, doing sort of battle with the realism of rhetoric, that how do we achieve true justified belief, and I think that breaks out into basically technique, methodology.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the safer harbors.
Sure.
Take the people out of it, leave the process in place.
But in this case, one wants to cling to that, because if we simply subject these kinds of stories to the most elemental truth tests, there is no evidence anywhere except sort of the behavior of committing to it.
But even evidence has morphed. To me, evidence, sure, that central word that really everything sort of oscillates around. If you really understand evidence, and if people are trained to recognize good evidence versus bad evidence, right, and know the rules for that, then you can't believe something like the big lie. If you detach, if you come up with a new definition of evidence, which is non-evidence is evidence, the fact that we can't find this doesn't disprove it. All the things that are done in the big lie and lie-ism in general to detach evidence, because evidence,
well, that is the rhetorical point of view. What counts as proof is whatever is convincing. In other words, right thinking moderns want to say, well, there's absolutely no evidence of that, but evidence is a phenomenon of what makes it evident. And if you're talking to one of these people, that makes it evident to me, even though it's very clear to me, although they're not. So they may present evidence, just not good evidence or provable evidence, right?
How many people in general ever get trained what evidence is supposed to look like? It's again all this sort of assumed informal learning of logic and logos and thinking that then when you see it break down, when you see the berserkers come in and the people torpedo big truth and all this stuff coming in, and you're like, how can people believe this? Well, we're not very shored up on our base logic.
Right. But I don't know that it's just that. It would be nice if it were just that. But I've observed it in teaching the phenomenon where I tried to teach argument, and then the person was not able to do it. But when they came in to complain about their grades, they were brilliant. And I think, once again, if you look back to that anecdote about the person doing the whataboutism logical exercise, they're doing a brilliant job of making discriminations and distinctions, right? It's just not guided by... It's not guided by a desire for truth. It's guided by trying to come up with the conclusion that you want. So, we confront rationality and rationalization are very closely related phenomena.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think you're going to find among the discriminating information that runs counter to what they want, their ability to scrutinize evidence is probably pretty good. But that to them is trapped in another exercise of validating their core beliefs or something. So, anyway.
So what are some of the answers as a rhetorician, if we are again selling ourselves at some level as, hey, we've got some answers for you world?
What are the rhetorical answers?
To the big lie, what do you do to counter the big lie in effective ways?
I think you have to work the angle that the only thing that really will rupture the big lie is when it quits working for people. Maybe this is not what you're looking at. It would be nice if it were just a technique or something that we could bottle, but
that's what everybody wants. Like in business, that's what I'm always asked for. Well, what's the exact answer that will make this happen? And I'm like, well.
I had this moment listening to the stuff about vaccinations and how there are these companies that are unwilling. This is my own event of whataboutism, I guess. They want to make it a choice as to whether you come back to work, in other words, or whether you get vaccinated or not, even though they have every right and ability to say, if you want to work next to these other people, you're going to come back vaccinated, right? And it occurred to me, well, you know, okay, this company has the authority and the will to make people be drug tested, but not to get vaccinated. This is my what about?
That's exactly right. That's, yeah.
So, you know, I'm less concerned in 90% of the occupations that my friend might have smoked a joint in the last 2 weeks than I am that he's got toxic COVID germs on me, right? it may depend on your job. However, so I guess back to the relevance of this is that when these companies decide that they're willing to risk because of political pressures, which is the only reason for many of them to require drug testing, as far as I'm concerned, that when it becomes politically fashionable, the cost-benefit ratio, they will say, okay, you know, and I think people are going to confront that in their lives. I think you're already seeing it in the dwindling numbers of resistance. The more people get vaccinated, the more venues that say you must be vaccinated, the more peer pressure, that edifice of that lie will slowly crumble, right? The more that you have 100 million people walking around without significant deformities, whatever it is they think is going to happen, that it eventually it will run up against the recalcitrance of reality. And that's accomplished by, you know, consensus and authorities and the legal establishment. So we just need for that traction to take hold, for it to be good business to say, you know, our company wants people vaccinated, period. So right now they're kind of in the carrot and stick, you know, kind of.
Yeah.
Well, we'll give you free tickets. We'll buy you a beer. We'll get you a sandwich.
Well, and again, this is why when I look at rhetoric, and if you really do have a holistic vision of what influence is, like all your options, like they're doing, is it in West Virginia where they're giving away a lottery ticket? Basically, you can win $1 million if you get vaccinated.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, so you're using all these things that the capitalist system basically has created. You're just borrowing those to see if you can get any kind of vax, you know, movement. But if you're really designing this out, so like that, like social pressure or the idea of evidence over time, you know, observed evidence, like you've seen friends who have got this vaccination, you've watched them for a month, their life is better, they don't have to wear this mask, nobody's giving them shit, and they're not sick. Then that becomes a type of evidence maybe that people can penetrate, that, you know, the cognitive fury going on inside of their heads from the big lie.
Well, I like that cognitive fury. I think what is problematic in all of these conversations, and it is in part a scientific mindset conceit that we've inherited, is that in the science point of view, belief is binary. It's either true or it's false. And that's putatively testable somewhere. And we're willing to conceive that, you know, there's some things that we just are not yet able to test. And those are our theory in some capacity, I guess, or are hypothetical. But I don't think that's the way people function. I don't think religious belief has the same. There are a lot of people kind of unsure, and so on certain occasions they'll say, I believe that, other occasions they won't. And that's the other methodological problem, is people's utterances are not really right. Indicative of. So I think what we have to do is deconstruct the idea of belief. And there are some people for whom these beliefs are so salient and thoroughgoing, and their profile as a believer is to cling to uncertainty and try to make their actions consistent with those beliefs. One of the statistics is the only religion for whom the big lie about the election is more popular are the fundamentalist Christian evangelicals. So 61% of those in the United States are big believers, right? Not just iffy believers, but big believers in the big lie. So there's all these, right? Okay, so you've got these things lining up. The source of truth, where you get your news, along with, right, your fundamental religious profile, along with your political party, along with your race, right? Somewhere around the 37% of white Americans believe the big lie, but only 9% of black Americans. Why is that? Is it because they have fundamentally different logical orientations? Or no, not at all, right? So at any rate, how do you believe this? And for most people, I think beliefs and what they're willing to articulate as beliefs are tentative and situational. So how else could we get such a dramatic change in the population in the last dozen years or so about, say, gay marriage, which at one time was a determinative political position, our legalization of marriage? So these changes do occur over time, dramatically. One of the dramatic changes in the last 20 odd years is the political affiliation of people with a college degree. In 1994, 52% of the people with a college degree voted Republican, whereas in the last election, by 2019, only 37%. Whereas the almost exact opposite in Democrats. So there's a huge kind of demographic shift there. So all of those beliefs didn't, you know, sustain this logical process of changing these things. And it's a rather complex and textured thing where what I'm willing to say is, I believe, is going to undergo revision depending on rewards and punishments and, right, whether that's working for me socially or not working for me socially, and the kinds of things one encounters, right?
Yeah, so it's this kind of multiplicity of fluidity of belief. So there are all these darts constantly coming into belief that are moving it around as opposed to this hardened.
Well, I think the idea of you know, the way we handle cognitive dissonance, that we walk around with dissonant items, right, in our attitudes, beliefs, and values and our cognitive elements, and that we spend a lot of time reconciling that. So that's one of the number one strategies of persuasion, is to put those things in dissonant relation, to say your actions here are really, you know, just a casual example in the last week or two. Bitcoin, okay, somebody came out with this report that Bitcoin uses far more energy than any form of transaction, if you think about it. What is required to, you know, to do the simplest transaction? And so Musk, who drove up the price of Bitcoin a few weeks ago by buying into it, saying, okay, we'll take that as payment for Teslas, reversed the position, right? So because now we have all these millennials saying, oh my God, this is you know, a high energy, a wasteful, whereas the previous 2 weeks. So those things, those behaviors got put in dissonant relationship with one another, and something has to be revised, basically. So back to the strategy of how do you intercede with this kind of, with the big lie, it seems to me that once again, do as much as one can to introduce dissonance into the life world of those. And accepting back, say, the statistics, say, so a profile of somebody like a evangelical Christian who does not take in a wide source of information, gets continual reinforcement in one particular kind of activity and social group, and has a certain kind of belief profile through which 61% of those are going to resist the realities that get presented in favor of commitment to a belief.
Yeah, and I've seen it with the fundamentals. I've dove into that a little bit, watching the particulars of how that works out. Like, their dissonance is a religious, mythological dissonance about the end of the world and Jesus, and, you know, the fact that Trump has been sold as part of that mythology and it never disavowed it, you know, never gave them much to doubt it. Even, like, they dumped all his realism, you know, the reality of his life, they just dumped that and made him a mythological character.
Sure.
And so he has the ability to fulfill that role of redeemer and savior in the end times and that kind of stuff, that kind of big bombastic character. So it goes back to he fills the story slot.
Well, and yeah, I mean, in some department in that ideology is how to rationalize almost any information. I'm reminded of the story of the downtown sermonizer minister who's preaching to the mission, right? The drunk, whatever. And the old drunk who says, "This is all really boring." And the minister says, "See, that's evidence the devil is here, right? Among us, right?" It has all of these ways of safeguarding, right, and covering over. So at the same time, the fact that Trump is, you know, a person who's openly guilty of infidelities and divorces and other moral shortcomings.
The evidence doesn't matter. The story.
Well, because the Lord moves in mysterious ways, and
you can disavow all of that.
And the Bible is really long, and we can find one guy that fits the profile. So anyway.
And I wonder. So like as we look at this idea, and I'm just trying to find how do you take this stuff and move it out into the world. So it's like people right now on the left are experiencing a lot of dissonance about the right in general. And the fact that this has boiled up to the term the big lie just is increasing the dissonance about, you know, this is a Hitlerian technique.
Right.
And I want to give people, maybe it's just therapy, you know, maybe it's just a therapeutic band-aid against all that dissonance. But hey, if you run into this, like here are ways that you might want to counter it. And so like that, like storyism is something I try to teach people a lot. I'm like, well, quit doing cognition with people that have swallowed story, because you're not going to get them back into cognitive world. You've got to stay in story world.
You need a better story.
Yeah. So even if like, okay, you've put Trump in as redeemer. Well, let me see if I can replace somebody. See if I can push somebody in there that's better, you know, than Trump. And then it makes sense, like as a story struggle. Now we have a characterological struggle. Instead of me saying all this evidence about his shitty, you know, behavior and personality and his life and all that evidence, they don't want to hear that. If I give him a better character, then I might win that story struggle.
Sure. Well, I mean, in theory, that's right. I mean, and that gives rise to certain strategies and tactics. But think about what you're up against. I mean, you're right. If you could supplant all of those stories with other stories where the person who believes this is the one who gets the woman, the person who believes this is the one who is promoted at work, the person who believes this is the one that Jesus really likes. If you could really, you know, offset all of those narratives, you would truly profoundly change the culture. But that's just part of why, right, in the beginning as the word is a powerful premise to all things that, right? Because we got big story.
Yeah, we got big story. Big story, big lie. They work together really well.
And eventually, you know, over time, we've proven that things will, you know, reinterpret. It's like the Constitution. There's enough ambiguity there that eventually through, you know, revision, you can change the orientation. But.
Well, let me ask you about this, because I hear this a lot. Maybe it's from, I don't know, from a certain perspective of having taught for a long time and seeing, once you get older, you see the culture move through different things. But here, I've talked to a lot of different people who look at this royal, you know, all this stuff going on, this battle and this discord. And they're like, this has always been here. We'll work our way through it. And yeah. I keep coming back to the simulacrum and the rise of digital media and even the rise of cable media as new factors. Like they may change the game. Like these have never been in place in American, in human culture, where you get this kind of access and this high production value down a distribution chute that has no gatekeepers, right into people's brains. So maybe the big lie at this point has been enabled and empowered in a way that has never been before. Hitler handed out little transistor radios to the entire country, so they had to listen to his shit, but it's still coming to you through a radio.
Sure.
So I don't know. It's like, am I overreacting and giving too much credence to modern production and distribution? Or
not at all. But what does it change that's fundamentally about it? Because I'm usually suspicious of the academic desire to always say, oh, it's always been that way, because you can always come up with a historical precedent. Yet at the same time, I think what I was getting ready to say, it was before we went there, is that one of the counter strategies would be history. To look back, you know, for instance, I was watching Fareed Zakaria's recent thing on the Republican Party. If you start looking back, this is not a set of new Republican strategies. Restrictions were there from almost the beginning, okay? And it didn't just start in the last, or even post-Reagan. So I think historicizing many of these phenomena is a useful thing to do. And that makes it very difficult to then assess, which has been one of the topics that I've thought most about, I think, is what difference does media make? And I think you have to, because we're always wanting to blame the media, just like we always want to blame the messenger. And there are certain things that get changed, you know, how space and time. And I think in this case, for instance, something Elizabeth and I were talking about, she uncovered a statistic that over 70% of the Facebook users are conservatives. Is that shocking? And it occurred to me that maybe an explanation for this, why, how did we arrive there, was that, which I think is a media phenomenon related to the current political breakout, is that a lot of the rural communities only gained internet access in the last dozen years or so, right? So media is a factor in terms of what you're participating in. And one thing that media does is enhance participation. Well, there are historical parallels for that we weren't prepared for. So, you know, I recall one story about early in the 20th century where it got announced on the radio, I guess, that Charlie Chaplin and Errol Flynn would be landing at the New York airport. They had no clue that 120,000 people would show up. And this is this, right? So we didn't even have consciousness of the mass that was being created by the medium.
Right.
And I think we're always ignorant about that. And I think this is another case. We're not really conscious of the mass that's been created by the medium of internet communication in the last dozen years or so. So that's certainly one way. I mean, clearly all media conquers space and time, but I think digital media, in terms of the people it delivers and how it delivers them, that is something new. But content isn't necessarily, if that makes sense. The kinds of strategies, for instance, when I read the FBI or CIA profile of Adolf Hitler, that's eerily familiar.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
In terms of identifying the strategy. And it could well be that, you know, had they the records, they could find, you know, Popes that did that. I don't know. So it isn't, you know, the means of persuasion maybe needs to give way somehow to the modes of persuasion. And maybe that's what you will do with the 21 Colosseums.
Well, I'm just trying to give like a language so that people can at least see. The first thing is just to see that there are theories and strategies. And ergo, you can move across them to get different effects, or you're being affected by different ones. And so like there's something I heard a while back where they're saying, somebody was positing that if Nixon had had Twitter and digital media, he would never have gotten clamped on by Watergate. Like it would never have got him out of office because he was actually smart with politics and stuff like that. Like, but the fact that Trump moved through that world, he was the first one there. Like he was the first Viking to land on the unprotected shores of England at that moment on the social media. And so there was no, there were no protections. Like even the fact that when he finally propagated the big lie and they took him off Twitter and Facebook and knocked him off the continent, you know, that was a protection that should have been in place years and years before. But because this is a new media world, they weren't there. There were no protections against somebody coming in usurping all the tools and techniques and weapons that are just laying there on the ground in that medium.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I've been working here is a suggestion that Trump isn't so much the first one to use those, although he certainly used them a lot, that the, that medium, internet and Facebook, delivered a whole new population to the enterprise. And yes, there are certain things about governing by tweet that are different, right? Different from what Obama did, different from, right? So whereas you could say back in the Nixon day, we had these outliers, we had John Birchers. Right. We had, subcults of belief, but that they just weren't enacted. And, you know, and they share similar demographics of the population. But that population was never given voice in the sense,
right,
in the dominant medium the way that this has. So cable news, just the ability to start your own station, the ability, shock radio. All of these things are precursors to Trump. So in a way, is he the first? He's the first to bring all-star wrestling dramatism, right, to Facebook. And there are some other new things there. For instance, once again, as we observed earlier, kind of the excellent echo chamber, because it makes it seem this is social media, so you think society is somehow being represented here.
Yeah, and I guess that's always what I go back to, the fact that these story structures, the modalities of persuasion have been around forever. And what's happened now is because the production value has gone way up, because the technology is good at producing stories, and the distribution has, a new distribution system has cropped up without any type of rules or structures in it yet. The fact that there was no gatekeeper in the John Birch Society days, they could hand out pamphlets, you know, but there was gatekeepers on CBS. Walter Cronkite was not having those people on every night to scream whatever they wanted to scream. And so the lack of gatekeepers, right, the lack of understanding of this, that we have no architecture, there's no rhetorical protection architecture in place. So maybe instead of like the EPA, we need the RPA, or the Rhetoric Protection Agency, where it's like, hey, you know, you can't allow this kind of unfiltered talk into your massive public discourse in that way, unfettered.
This is a genuine journalist question, and of course, Facebook's been struggling with that. And what right do they have to restrict people for saying certain kinds of things? You know, Twitter as well. So I think we're confronting that moment of, one journalist saying, you know, if I took any other group of people and they were just going to come on and tell lies, why would I do that? What obligation do I have to let them come on and tell lies?
Right.
So
the journalists aren't empowered enough. To me, like the fact that it's this kind of civility, the kind of objectivity, all that kind of stuff, where they don't have the power if they're the purveyors of big truth, like they're trying to find truth versus science trying to find truth versus rhetoric trying to find truth, or even philosophy. Philosophy gets so deep into it that it becomes useless very quickly to me. But just the rhetoric of like, hey, here are five markers to look at that will tell you this is now the big lie. Now we've got to train everybody to see those markers. Like the thing that you did, the little profile of Trump Hitler, was perfect. It just laid out how you do a big lie. You know, right, never admitting you're wrong, blaming the other side with everything. And you're like, well, let's see if we can find evidence of that in the GOP talk. And it's like, oh, look, there it is.
Well, and you know, when you ask what does media do to enable this, you know, a primer really is Orwell's 1984. I mean, it's anticipating what Twitter does so well. If everybody's attending to it, the sizable population, it increases the speed by which you can get a story out there, and it decreases their, it amplifies the ability to repeat it over and over again. As though, once again, if you did that on the radio, that's one thing. It only, you know, that, but if you do it where it echoes throughout all the, you know, pseudo media, if you will, that's another thing, right? To where people are repeating it to each other. That's what, anyway, so it increases all of those, but it also makes, their duration less, so they don't have longevity.
Well, it's bumper cars. Like, you're sitting there in one and just bam, bam. I mean, there is no, like, the things that, what I was saying earlier, the foundations of being able to think logically, the burden of cognition on that is slow. Like, it takes.
Right. And I think that this is what gives favor to things like whataboutism, is that you can get people to chase their tail to where I give up. Right. There's a nullification of the other truth industries out there that is easy to do. And if given the right motivation through rationalizing one's commitments, once again, one can play that game over and over again and think that you have yourself arrived at a conclusion when you really just arrived at your premise. So
right. Anyway. Well, tell me what you think of this, because I listed this week because I want to do some work on my friend, and he's pretty thinky. He's just lost in the skew, but he's a pretty thinky person. So it's going to have some logic foundation to it that he hasn't heard yet. And one is, I hear a lot of people will locate the source of decision-making, the ultimate decision-making source. There's just a lot right now in themselves, in the individual. You know, it's the whole libertarian thing. And I'm like, one of the things I want to present to him is like, here are the 25 sources, categories that you could potentially believe. You are the least credible of all of them. Like, you have the least experience, the least training, the least, you have no direct interaction with any of these topics and people that you're, why do you rely on you? You're the worst option.
Right. I think you're onto something there. And I think coordinates with what I was talking about, the ideology of voting, that it's my decision that I make in the sacred space there. It's sort of a religious exercise, that the way we've constructed this, that my vote, my conscious decision here, and that's why people then get into these sort of paralyzed, or spiraling logical problems of offsetting. Well, so I'm not going to vote on party. I'm not going to vote on, right? These other, so I can neutralize all of these different conflicting narratives, and eventually, you know, they can just get negated. What do I want to, you know? It's sort of like speaking to God in terms of the privacy of my interior moral consciousness. And so I will vote for somebody who's not going to win and thereby elect the wrong guy. So, you know, it's. At any rate, I think you're right, that this is part of the construction of individualism, and that somehow I need to be in the driver's seat of this. And of course, maybe the backside of that is sort of the apathy that we've experienced of people not believing that they have any ability or stake in these things. So the kind of the depoliticization.
Right.
It's interesting that in 2020 we had the highest turnout in modern history, whereas in 2016 we had the lowest, right? Where people did not see that they could do this kind of moral exercise.
Well, and I see it over and over again across many different areas, not just politics. When I do my losing 125 pounds show, at one point, the big turn into the second act is I say, okay, I'm going to tell you the one thing, the one thought I ever had that made a difference about whether I was overweight or underweight. And this has changed everything. I didn't have it until I was like 40 or 42. And it was this, is that I'm ignorant. I should not be in charge of this. I don't understand food. I don't understand my body. I don't understand why I eat what I do. I should not be in charge. And the fact that I could reach to the ethos of the ignorant, and then I tag it with, I'm from Kentucky. You would have thought I would have recognized ignorance earlier, but that I'm not worthy of being in charge of this. So I need to go find somebody who has the ethos to be in charge.
Well, you've uncovered step one of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? that the syndrome of alcoholism is to believe that you have power over the bottle. And the first thing you've got to do is break that cycle, right? No. When I bring out chocolate in the evening, we eat it.
Well, and it's interesting because America fights this battle between individualism and community so often. And we so often land on the offer to the individual and the primacy of the individual and that kind of, you know, avocation of the individual. And I see it in so many people that get into these difficult situations where they end up not trusting mega systems and institutions. And then they retreat to, well, I'm the best source. And I'm like, no, you're the worst source for cognitive decision-making, especially. So what are we going to do about that for you? And the first thing I have to do is get them to that same space where they discredit themselves.
Sure. And I think that is a really huge component of the kind of the libertarianism of the, you know, the Trump movement is that that empowerment that I have to know more than anybody else. I think partially the, you know, think about the conspiratorial thinking that is fueled by that. And the contrarian nature of it. It's because, you know, the only one belief that I really hold and enact with consistency is the one that says, what if everybody else believes it, it must be wrong. It must be a lie. So it is the search for the big truth that fuels the big lie, right?
Yeah, and I totally.
And I think that's the academic stand. Is if you're not looking for either one, you stand a much better chance of coming up with the correct description of what's going
right.
on.
Right. Yeah. If you don't enter the binary, you're probably, you know, better.
So off. So we note among the 61% of evangelical Christians who believe the current big lie, they are enabled by that because they have a big truth. Right. You got to have a category of a big truth.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of the thing. It's like, you get to the point where I'm now convinced that I can't trust anyone, that everybody's lying to me, like all systems lie. Da, da, da. And so the retreat again, against that dissonance and against that cognitive storm, because people can't live in that type of cognitive storm for very long. The retreat seems to be either I retreat back into individualism or I retreat back into my religion, you know, some type of big theocracy system where I've got a big, you know, mystical being making my decisions for me. But that sense of everything is falling apart as far as the anchors and the systems allow me to think about things in public and make sense. Ergo, I just push it all aside. I'm not going to listen to anybody about anything. And I'm just going to make the decision over here.
I think that is kind of the reward structure for being online and going to these sources and, you know, believing that you yourself have wrought this truth, done your research, that is, you know, I guess part of the identity politics. It's not just a passive phenomenon. It is the enactment of the identity.
So. Yeah, and it's absorbed deeply. Like you see this issue, to me, a lot of times it is the main issue. What I do this little rhetorical trick on them. I'm like, so you can't rely on you. Why don't you just rely on me? Like I'm a rhetorician. Like,
you know, well, I've always used that answer to the, you know, the canard of, well, who's going to decide the sort of truth is real? I say, well, I will. Okay, let's just start that conversation. I'll decide. I'm not troubled by this.
You know, and then like, as soon as you step into the cloak, you know, of decider and standing on the pedestal, you know, they begin to attack you. And I'm like, no, you already have decided I'm a good person, that I'm smarter than you. I'm way more trained in this than you. You know, I like you and I'm trying to do good things for you. So you're much better off trusting me and you don't Absolutely. Even need to question that stuff. And so it's this ethos move, which is what you really need in order to be able to have effect on people, is that they just trust your information. And again, this is why I start Rhetoric Warriors as an ethical only persuader movement. It's because that same shit is done by people who are going to take you down dark paths. But I'm not going to take you down dark paths. I'm going to take you down the lighted path. And so you can trust me. Like, it's literally getting people to trust the phrase, "you can trust me."
back to the root of ethos, right? Intelligence, character, and goodwill. And goodwill being mostly, do you have the audience's best interests in mind, right? So that's the essential claim.
Yeah. So it should be like there's a rhetorician on stage or whatever with a air horn. Every time he hears a big lie, he just blows it off, or, you know, big electric sign that says big lie, like stay away, danger, danger. Because people are overwhelmed. That's what I keep getting to over and over again. And one of the retreats is to be like, fine, it's all junk. I'm just going to sit over here and I'll be prime in it. Or I'll sit over here and just listen to Christian, you know, my Christian faith, or I'll just listen to Trump, you know, I'll stop thinking about it and I'll just listen to one person. That's why ethos keeps coming back to me again and again and again as the simple answer, which means it has superpower in this overcomplicated environment.
Right. And I think that that's, you know, even though it's fraught with danger.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
It is the best answer, which is that we want to affirm humanity here somehow. This is a better way of making the decision than through purely facts, because they can also be skewed one way or the other, right?
And they're good at it. That's what the big lie is evidence of, is just how easy it is to screw up facts and cognition, and it's very effective. Maybe because of the media now, maybe because these techniques haven't been used very often in America. So Americans really aren't used to protecting themselves, you know, from the full force of a big lie. You saw there's always lying in politics. And like you said, the right has been using these techniques for a long time, but we've never seen it come like blitzkrieg, you know, it's never blitzkrieged into America. McCarthyism, I guess.
Yeah, like you say, and you know, I think there was a lot of trepidation. There was a lot of conflict in the early 60s. There were ideological changes. There was a lot of suspicion, a lot of anger, there was a lot of division. I think there was more of a containment of that in the political. You know, politics weren't such a looming part, and maybe that's another media related phenomena. And maybe it's because the stakes weren't the same. So,
well, that was also a big truth movement, right? That was piercing the governmental non-truths about the war and all that kind of stuff. So there was a really
sure. But that came along with a lot of suspicion, you know, I was kind of a lot of these things kind of changing their political polarities that we've talked about. All of a sudden, you know, here's the boomer crowd being so happy about the FBI and the CIA telling the truth, right? Whereas 20 years ago, that would have been exactly, they're the ones perpetuating the lies. Is when I saw, I guess it was Colbert interviewing Oliver Stone, and Colbert sort of stating as a matter of fact that Russia had skewed the election, and Oliver Stone going, "What, you believe those people? Didn't I tell you to never believe the FBI and the CIA?" And then now Oliver Stone's on TV interviewing Putin in a very favorable series of, you know, you go, wait a minute, you know, Oliver Stone was the guy that told us the truth about Kennedy. Well, you know, it is confusing even for, you know,
right? And that's why I think that's why people just abandon it. Like, I can't pierce it. I can't detangle it. I'm just going to go over here and grab a simpler choice. And I'm just going to stay with it. I'm gonna make it hardened. I don't want to hear any more shit. Yeah.
Well, I think the dissonance can breed disaffection. So it's only when that moves into your life world and decisions are forced that we have to do that kind of sorting. And of course, you know, economic hardship, unfortunately, or right. war are the big factors that intervene there. So,
well, cool. I think we've big truthed, right?
We're big truthed, huh?
Aren't we? Or at least small truth or medium truth. Which are we?
Well, we're rescuing the baby from the bathwater. We've at least done a profile sketch on the baby, so we know where to look for it. It's out in the yard somewhere.
That's funny.
To milk the metaphor, but
we've done a little sketch. You can see the kind of ear over here, and maybe
There is a baby, and we should keep looking. And crowdsourcing maybe is not the best way to find it. So.
Well, again, I appreciate it. I enjoy these. And I think if people can sift their way through it, there's a lot in here. We kind of move around, but I think there's value in hearing from the rhetoricians and, you know, that terminology.
Especially on a subject like lie. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is what rhetoric gets accused of being. The entire thing is just this lying. Like, it's all just the art of lying, you know, the sophistry of rhetoric.
Well, it's not a binary proposition. Once again, that we live and work and make decisions in a world that is fraught with, you know, these kinds of contradictions and ambiguities, and where there is not, you know, certainty isn't possible. So,
yeah. So again, you need complex times, more sophisticated techniques.
And I think that is the bottom line: is don't expect there will be no magic moment where all that goes away.
Damn it!
This is always the case. We're going to have to keep working at it.
That's what I want to sell. I like magic moments. America loves to sell magic moments. Like, there should be a rhetoric pill. Okay, they're giving you the red pill and the blue pill. Here's the white pill right in the middle, and that's going to clear everything up. That's what I want to sell, because that's the easiest thing to sell. But we'll keep going at it. Again, appreciate it. And this has been the Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. We will come back at you next time. Get out there and keep persuading. Of course, the world needs it.